Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray. Drop what you're doing.
Tasers are supposed to be used on those who endanger law enforcement officers or others during a crime or in the process of an arrest, but that's not what happened to Philip Chappell. Mr. Chappell was not a danger or threat to the trooper, he was not a danger or threat to himself, and he wasn't a danger or threat to anyone else, Philip Fabiano, Chappell's attorney, said. He was simply sleeping. I might have shared this story with you before, but I'm going to share with you again, assuming that I've already done so, as sort of an appetizer or an aperitif to a story that's coming up after this that is perfectly outrageous, even more so than this. Fabiano says Chappell was in the backseat of a yellow cab, having decided to call a cab rather than after drinking too much at a Steelers exhibition game in August of 2008. He made what I think most people would agree was the responsible decision not to get behind the wheel, Fabiano said. Instead, 29-year-old Chappell and a buddy took a cab from Hinesfield to Washington, Pennsylvania. When they fell asleep in the back and the driver couldn't wake them, the cabbie took them to the state police barracks in Washington. What is it with people who insist on getting the police involved where there is no reason to do so? I don't understand that. Well, I do understand it, I think, instinctively. That's a reflection of the way that we have been socialized. What's the purpose of the government school system? Well, it's not merely to educate, it's not to impart knowledge, it's not to help train young minds. What is the first thing people always say when they're objecting to homeschooling? Well, how is your kid going to get socialized? He's not going to be properly socialized. He's not going to school. Who's going to socialize him? And of course, my answer would be, I don't want him to be a socialist. Why would I want to send him to government school to be socialized? What does that mean? It means cultivated, programmed deference to supposed government authority. It means coveting the role of a hall monitor. It means indoctrinating people to become snitches. It means teaching kids to curry favor with authority figures by cutting down others. It encourages kids to develop a prosecutorial mindset. That reminds me of something I meant to discuss last week, and I'll probably discuss it again. I've mentioned before what the word, I believe it's from the Greek, diabolos, from which we derive devil, what that word means. It means the accuser. There's a phrase that many people use without fully understanding, and they often misuse it, and that phrase is devil's advocate. Whenever somebody is going to express, by way of testing out the logic of a controversial proposition, an opinion that they don't fully endorse but want to be considered for the purpose of discussion, they'll usually preface said opinion with a phrase, just let me play devil's advocate here. In other words, let's run it up the flagpole, see who salutes, to use the advertising cliche from the 1950s. Well, that's not what the phrase devil's advocate refers to. As I understand the origins of that phrase, it has to do with the process of canonizing saints in the Roman Catholic faith. A devil's advocate is somebody who finds fault with the candidate for canonization, somebody who underscores and brings into sharp relief that person's sins, foibles, failings, failures. In other words, the devil's advocate is a prosecutor. He's playing the role of the devil. He is being the vicar of the devil by accusing somebody. That's the mindset that results from being socialized in government schools. And that's why people seek any excuse, quite frankly, to implicate the apparatus of state coercion in the form of the police in matters that really have nothing to do with the defense of life, liberty, and property. As if that were the function of the police, the protection thereof, and it isn't. It used to be, at least in some places. It isn't anymore. It hasn't been probably for the last decade and a half or longer. Anyhow, once again, we have this cabbie who takes these people to the police department, and there's no reason to do so. And what happens? According to a federal lawsuit filed by Chappell, That's where Trooper Jeffrey, I believe it's pronounced Ogrodowski, used a taser on Chapel in the back seat of the cab and forcibly removed him. A police complaint filed against Chapel at the time says that Chapel apparently in a drunken sleep tried to shush the trooper away. Oh boy! Felonious shushing? What is this guy, Siegfried from Get Smart? This is chaos! We don't shush here! He shushed and made a hand movement, and that was it, and he fell back to sleep, Fabiano said. That's when Ogrodowski used the taser on Chapel, who had a heart pacemaker. That's the part of the story, assuming I've read this and shared this with you before, that's the part of the story I want to underscore here. He has a heart pacemaker. He's had a pacemaker implanted in his chest since he was 13 months old. He has a congenital heart defect. This goon in a uniform uses an electroshock torture device on a sleeping guy who's intoxicated, who's done the responsible thing, who's got a heart pacemaker. Heart pacemakers don't react well to tasers. If he had died, if he had been murdered by Ogrodowski, the official coroner's inquest would have blamed his heart defect. It wouldn't have been that the police killed him. He just happened to die when the police intervened with the portable electroshock torture device, the PEST, which is how I like to refer to the taser. That brings us to the following story, and I'm going to read it as it was published on Lou Rockwell's blog by yours truly. Anna V. Ramirez probably didn't want to call the police last April when her adult son, Christian Pagan, forgive me, it's not Pagan, it's Pagan, had what was described as a violent outburst. She certainly didn't want the police to use a taser on the 25-year-old, who was born with the heart defect and Down syndrome. Those two things, unfortunately, often go together. He's a handicapped kid, Ramirez told the Miami-Dade Police Department's 911 dispatcher. I don't want them to shoot him with a taser. Within minutes of their arrival at the family's home in West Kendall, the police had shot Pagan 6 times with a taser. Ramirez and her other son, 21-year-old Hernando Yunus, tried to shield Christian with their bodies, pulling the taser prongs from his clothing and pleading with the police to stop. Ramirez herself was shot with the portable electroshock torture device before she and Hernando were arrested for the supposed crime of resisting arrest without violence. According to the Miami Herald, quote, prosecutors dropped Ramirez's case last month but refiled the charges Thursday, that's August 4th, after police complained. David Mayer, assistant state attorney for Miami-Dade County, told the paper that the case had been dropped by mistake. Christian, who was hospitalized for 2 weeks, was not charged in the incident. His mother, who quit her job as a manager at Circuit City in order to be her son's full-time caretaker, says that he refuses to sleep, which may lead to potentially fatal health complications. This guy's got a heart defect. He's not sleeping. That's not a good combination. Idiana Felipe, the officer who initially fired the taser, although at least one other officer reportedly did so as well, insists that she did so, quote, for my safety. There it is again, officer safety, the highest and holiest of all considerations, as the agitated but handicapped and unarmed young man violently charged at me. She arrested Anna and Hernando because their frantic efforts to protect Christian from potentially lethal violence obstructed Felipe's efforts, quote, to perform my lawful duties, the officer claimed in her report. What this means is that Anna Ramirez faces the prospect of spending 1 year minus a day behind bars. The official sentence could be 364 days in imprisonment, because she took action to subdue her son without using lethal force, something the government-trained, taxpayer-subsidized officers either couldn't or wouldn't do because making an attempt would compromise officer safety. Of course, if Christian had been fatally electrocuted, the official account would blame the death on the young man's congenital heart defect, perhaps coupled with excited delirium, rather than a criminal assault that was committed despite repeated specific warnings by a tax feeder in a government-issued costume. Think about that for a second and how commonplace this is for tasers to be used against people who are not committing acts of violence, much less acts of violence that threaten the lives of people in their immediate surroundings, people who have medical conditions, people who have psychological problems. It's a very commonplace thing. When tasers were first commonly issued about 20 years ago, they started popping up in Los Angeles and elsewhere. They were described as another rung on the escalation ladder in violent confrontations. They were an alternative to the use of firearms or other consistently, predictably lethal weapons. They offered an alternative to filling a body with hot lead, and they were only going to be used in circumstances in which firearms would be justified. That's not the case anymore. Now, really, they're the first tool and the most frequently used tool of police. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute. It takes so little to find yourself in trouble with what we are told to call the law. And chances are, if you find yourself in trouble, the people who are in charge of law enforcement will find some reason to justify their actions. Now, here's a really good example of this principle in action. This is from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Dateline Cedar Rapids, August 12th. Police in SWAT gear busted through a door and searched a Cedar Rapids home for drugs Thursday morning but came up empty. Okay, first of all, let's talk about the origins and purposes of SWAT for just a little bit. When SWAT was created in 1968 by Daryl Gates, yes, that same Daryl Gates, the purpose of a SWAT team was narrowly defined, and it was going to be used with austere infrequency, only in circumstances involving urban insurrectionary violence, urban terrorism, hostage situations, armed bank robberies, things of that sort. SWAT was actually baptized in gunfire in a completely unnecessary confrontation with a Black Panther militia group in Compton, California. It was one of these situations that grew out of a stupid, silly, petty dispute involving, if I remember correctly, a stereo that was being played too loudly. An LAPD officer went into this Black Panther hangout. I think it was a record store that fronted some kind of a glorified clubhouse for the Black Panther militia unit in Compton, because of complaints that they were playing their music too loudly. And from there, things got really ugly. If you happen to see, any of you have seen the version, the big screen version of Starsky and Hutch, starring Ben Stiller, that came out about 10 years ago, there's a scene in which David Hutchinson, who's the laid-back surfer dude, part of the cop duo, took Starsky with them when they were just newly made partners there in the Bay City Police Department. Bay City, of course, being, I guess, Oakland. Took him in to meet Huggy Bear, who operated his little fiefdom in the Black inner city of Bay City. And Starsky was demanding gun registrations, and basically he was cruising for some kind of trouble, and they were outgunned, they were outmanned. It was a stupid, silly situation. It was basically rectified in a good sense, not Orwellian sense, when Hutchison found some way to de-escalate the conflict. I mean, Starsky at one point had actually shot the tail off of Huggy Bear's iguana. And at that point, Huggy Bear's armed buddies were thinking about maybe shooting the tail off of Starsky. But Huggy Bear pointed out that would be disproportionate because an iguana can generate a second tail. And so, after Starsky apologized, the situation was de-escalated. But that's not what happened with the confrontation in Compton, California, in which the SWAT concept was baptized in fire. And unfortunately, since that time, things have only gotten worse. And I'll talk about that in more detail in just a second, but we have a caller. I believe Jeff is with us from Massachusetts this evening. Chelsea, Massachusetts. How you doing, Jeff?
Oh, I'm doing just fine. Well, as far as police are concerned, you have to realize that economic conditions create the outcome of where America is going towards. And I'll give you an example, and I'm going to take an unrelated topic and tie it in to the topic tonight. There was 30,000 people in Atlanta that went for Section 8 housing to 400 spots. What's this have to do with SWAT team? Everything, because these ghettos are dangerous. People don't realize that it's the low to moderate income housing that creates the ghettos, because when you give somebody something, guess what? They don't take care of it. It turns into a toilet, and especially a blue state like Massachusetts, where I live at, becomes a breeding ground for criminals and for all these third world countries to dump their problem children onto us. They know where the bacon is at, and these third world countries know exactly what they're doing, so they dump their illegals, their criminals, their revolutionaries onto Miami, Massachusetts, and places like that. And then these places breed this stuff. We have the biggest mosque in the Northeast in Roxbury, Massachusetts, for crying out loud. You know what kind of insurrection that's going to cause where all these Muslims are stationed at a mosque, and then they want to put in a ground zero mosque? What happens if the Muslims decide to do a jihad and say jihad in Arabic, and all of a sudden you got them pouring out of the mosque? SWAT is going to have their hands full, but people don't realize this. And you're going to see civil war on the streets where SWAT will be fighting all these insurrectionists, and people, Americans, don't have a clue. And we'll have a bigger police state, yeah.
What I think is going to happen with respect to the prospect of urban warfare here is that we have a military that is a training ground now for both street gangs and for the paramilitary police,
That's true.
Who go over to Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. For the most part, when they come back, the only jobs they're going to be able to find are going to be in the same kind of work domestically. And you're going to have quite a few instances, I believe, where people who were part of the same unit, part of the same regiment, or some other arrangement in a place like Iraq will come back, and some of them will end up becoming street cops, and some of them will end up becoming street gangs. I can see that happening. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised that hasn't happened more frequently. There are a number of instances I've read about in Chicago in particular where you have some people end up working with the so-called street crime units, which are counter-gang units, and you've got some other people who come back from Iraq, and they're helping to organize some of the ethnic gangs in Chicago. So we end up being caught in the crossfire here, and they're both trained and equipped by the United States government.
Exactly. And also, let me add, too, that that the police and the street gangs will be working with each other because if they're both street gangs, they'll be working with each other. And guess what? At the end of the day, you're right. The only jobs that are going to be around are these type of jobs. And also, in Massachusetts, We're way ahead of the game. Boston is paper shuffling hack jobs, union jobs, and everything else. We don't have a real industry in my state. What's keeping our state afloat is federal funds. We are a welfare basket case. Yes, we have hospitals and universities, but the only people that can really afford it, and I could be wrong, are rich sheiks from Saudi Arabia, for crying out loud, and foreigners who have money to spend.
Well, speaking of Muslim houses of worship, what do you think of the Tax Mahal, that IRS monstrosity that's being rebuilt at the cost of about, what, $100 million they set aside as a stimulus project to build and expand that IRS facility there in Massachusetts? Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yes. I'm familiar with that. I'm not familiar with the numbers, but I'm familiar with the fact that the government wants to expand it, I think it's in Andover, Massachusetts.
Andover.
What?
And it's for processing paper tax returns, which are becoming sort of scarce now that people are filing online. So they're spending $100 million of taxpayer money in order to create this huge campus there in Andover, Massachusetts. They're calling it a stimulus program, but it's not going to create any jobs. And the only jobs it would create would be really at the tax extraction point. So when you call it Taxachusetts,
you're right.
This is not a lazy pejorative. This is a careful, accurate description of that commonwealth.
Well, that's it. And you know what? If you do a study of communist Russia, guess what communist Russia was known for? Having tax enforcers militarize the Russian version of the IRS, plucking the people like Stalin's chicken. If you read the story of Stalin's chicken, it's a funny story. Stalin takes a chicken, plucks all of its feathers off in a freezing cold day, and the only thing the chicken has to go to is Stalin's undercoat.
Thanks for being on and sharing your point of view with us this evening, Jeff. It's great to have you. This is Will Greer, Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Jeff from Chelsea, Mass., calling in and talking with us about what's going on in the People's Republic of Taxachusetts. I made reference to the Tax Mahal. Of course, that's a play on Taj Mahal, which is an Indian palace that was built by a Muslim rather than a Hindu prince. Many people think that that's a Hindu house of worship. There was a memorable scene in one of these Michael Bay abominations, I believe it was Armageddon, where you had a group of Hindu pilgrims worshiping outside the Taj Mahal. And I said, wait a second, I think the Taj Mahal is actually a Muslim shrine. But the Tax Mahal in Andover is this $100 million monstrosity that's a stimulus project. And you had tax collector union officials pressuring everybody in New England to keep that Andover IRS office open. They process paper tax returns. More and more people are filing online, keeping the paper records in their filing cabinets rather than mailing them off for the rebate, because you can get an instant rebate. That is to say, the people who steal your tax dollars will give you back some sickly portion of that more quickly if you file online rather than using the snail mail system to mail off a paper tax return. Since about 2003, there has been a precipitous fall off in the number of paper tax returns that are processed. There were a number of offices that were supposed to be slated for closure. They were going to be shuttered by 2009. I believe that decision was made in 2002. Andover was on that list. Suddenly, every tax-devouring tax processor who had union representation was pressuring the congressional delegation from Massachusetts to keep the Andover office open. So when the federal government decided to start spending money in the name of stimulus, one of the projects that was at the top of the list was to build this epic-scaled monstrosity in Andover for the benefit of the IRS. So you're taking $100 million and giving it back to the IRS to build this huge facility that will include, I believe, an auditorium and leisure halls and all this stuff. And the way that they're justifying this expense is that they're going to say that it's a friendly, inviting environment. But, of course, if you're somebody who's a tax victim who's brought into the lair of the tax extraction bureaucracy, how inviting could the environment be? I mean, tales are told, I don't know whether this is true, that there was supposedly a string quartet at one point that was playing at the gates of Auschwitz in order to make the environment a little bit more user-friendly. Or to take a less ghastly and extreme example, one of the things that was said to the Japanese-Americans, the Issei, the Japanese-born Japanese-Americans, and the Nissei, who were American-born Japanese, as they were being rounded up to be put into what the FDR administration called concentration camps. They used the expression. That's not hyperbole. They used the expression concentration camps to describe these relocation centers. But as they were collected at the processing points, they were told all kinds of reassuring things about where they were going and how they'd be treated, and all of it was nonsense, of course. And so, you know, that might be a better example, a better analogy for creating an inviting environment at the Andover IRS facility. Before Jeff called, I was talking about SWAT and the origins thereof and the fact that they were baptized in gunfire and a completely avoidable standoff in Compton, California in 1968 that was resolved when SWAT sent off to, I believe, Pendleton, Camp Pendleton, for a rocket launcher. They actually had to contact the White House I think it might have been 1969 this happened, because I believe Richard Nixon was in the White House at the time. They had to get presidential authorization to get a single rocket launcher to use in this confrontation against a Black Panther militia unit. Now, this all grew out of a noise complaint. That's a really good example of the "from small acorns do mighty oaks grow" principle at work. Or from one tiny seed, a huge nest of nettles will spring. I mean, this was completely avoidable. But this italicizes, again, the way that avoidable conflicts, when they are not de-escalated, can become potential tragedies. This story from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is another good example of this. We've got a SWAT team conducting a routine search for narcotics. Why do they use a SWAT team? Because it's intimidating. Not because they were concerned that they would be dealing with a Mexican narcotics cartel cell in Cedar Rapids, but because they wanted to intimidate these people to conduct a search. Police in SWAT gear busted through a door and searched a Cedar Rapids home for drugs Thursday morning, but came up empty. The story should stop there, but you know it's not going to. At least 12 officers surprised the tenants at 1135 33rd Street Northeast when they arrived around 7 a.m. They always arrive at a really inconvenient time to catch people when they're at their most vulnerable. With a narcotics search warrant, Sergeant Christy Hamlin, a police spokeswoman, later confirmed that nothing was seized from the house. No one was taken to jail. But the tenants of the house, Justin Davis, 28, and his girlfriend, Erica Lewis, 26, were charged with disorderly house. Let me read that again. That's how it appears in the text of this news story. They were charged with disorderly house and signed a promise to appear in court, police said. No one was injured during the raid. Davis said his 5-year-old daughter was in her room when officers busted a hole in the front door. He said he came to the door when he heard a canine unit dog barking and was pulled outside, where he was told to lie face down in his front yard. He said the officers had him at gunpoint. That, of course, is felonious armed assault. It doesn't matter whether this is being conducted under the color of supposed law. This is felonious armed assault, as well as I would think you're dealing with additional charges that would spring from the wanton malicious destruction of property. Davis was visibly upset after police left and mentioned moving out of the area. "What do you think my neighbors think about me now?" Davis said. "My character has been assassinated, and I'm really upset about that." Davis said he and Lewis were handcuffed while officers searched. They were told police had information that there was drug activity at their house. Information is not evidence. What happened is that they were squeezing a user. Somebody snitched, simply made something up. And this was accepted as the basis of a warrant that led to this potentially tragic paramilitary raid against an innocent couple. Hamlin said search warrants are issued only after a judge reviews the evidence collected and signs the warrant. Oh, heavens. This is done reflexively, automatically, thoughtlessly. Judges don't care, for the most part. In general, police investigate tips about drug activity by interviewing neighbors, looking through trash, and using a drug-sniffing dog, Hamlin said. Apropos of what? What's the predicate? What's the probable cause? They're just trawling for any excuse they can find. We don't just take one person's word under normal circumstances, Hamlin said. Note the use of the cute little qualifier, normal. Davis said he is on probation and it would be stupid for him to be involved with drugs. They should have made sure they had concrete evidence before they knock on someone's door. Actually said knock in someone's door, Davis said. Disorderly house is described as a building or room where someone resorted to for, that's how it reads here, it's in quotation marks, where someone resorted to for illegal activity involving drugs, alcohol, gambling, or prostitution, according to a city ordinance. Now, disorderly house, as that expression was used in colonial-era law, almost always referred to prostitution. That's an expression somewhat akin to house of ill repute. But they were arrested on suspicion of disorderly house. They didn't find anything, so what's the cause for the suspicion? They found nothing. And in order to cover up for the fact that they kicked in this guy's house, held him and his girlfriend at gunpoint, terrorized a five-year-old child for no good reason, they're going to prosecute him on suspicion of disorderly house. You see, this is something that exists only within the opportunistic mind of an armed tax feeder. Suspicion of disorderly house. Let me read once again what it says here. Disorderly house is described as a building or room where someone resorted to for illegal activity involving drugs, alcohol, gambling, or prostitution, according to a city ordinance. It would be wise, those of you who are listening to this program, it would be wise of you to check and see if your city is afflicted with an ordinance of that sort. And if it is, it would be a good idea to see if there's something you could do to change it. Because chances are that they could find any reason to find any resident of any dwelling suspicious of maintaining a disorderly house. Sometimes it might be something, as a matter of fact, I've done some research into this subject, and I've found a number of cases of this sort, both recent and of earlier vintage. It may be something as innocuous as playing a stereo too loudly. But once again, they'll find a reason. They can always find a reason to justify in their own minds the violence that they do to us. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Stand by for more Sedition after this. If I had stayed in music, and sometimes I wish I had, if I had fashioned a career as a rock musician, although that wasn't really what I wanted to do, that wasn't my métier, I wanted to be a session musician. I did a little of that for a while, but if I had stayed in the realm of heavy rock, I might have changed my last name to something like Falkenrath. Think about that. That's a really good heavy metal name. Falkenrath. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome epic recording artist Falkenrath. Well, there is a fellow who is saddled with that surname. His name is Richard Falkenrath, and it's spelled just like it sounds. He is a former deputy homeland security advisor in the Bush administration, and he's somebody who is afflicted with a really bad case of police state envy, I think you'd call it. He wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times recently talking about how he was chartreuse with envy over the powers exercised by the United Arab Emirates. Now, an emirate, of course, is a kingdom ruled by an emir. That's not a political situation that I find all that appealing. I'm not a monarchist. I'm somebody who's a minarchist rather than a monarchist. To the extent that we're going to have any kind of an archy, any kind of a rule by government officials, I'd prefer that it be small, embattled. Indeed, as it's been said, that the government in question will be small enough to be drowned in the bathtub if necessary. So I don't particularly like monarchy of any flavor, any variety. I do think that some of the emirates are better than others. In Abu Dhabi, for instance, hosts a world freestyle grappling championship because the crown prince studied in California and became enchanted with Gracie style Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So there's something to be said about Abu Dhabi, and elsewhere there are a couple of places that are fairly attractive in some ways, but bear in mind that we're talking about a system of government, quite frankly a culture, which is not conducive to individual liberty. Now this guy, Richard Falkenrath, served in the Bush administration. The Bush administration was headed up by personalities who were sort of joined at the hip with some of the worst elements of the Muslim world. George W. Bush was photographed walking literally hand in hand with the King of Saudi Arabia. People make a big deal about Barack Obama bowing before the Saudi king. He wasn't walking hand in hand with him the way that Bush was. You know, the same people who make a big deal about Barack Obama bowing thought that it was somehow scurrilous and unfair to bring up these pictures of George W. Bush walking hand in hand with this Saudi despot. Well, six of one, half dozen of the other, as far as I'm concerned. And Dick Cheney has talked about the possibility of relocating to the United Arab Emirates. If he can get there without being arrested as a war criminal, that's, of course, a very interesting prospect. I'm going to read Jacob Sullum's summary of what Falkenrath had to say about why he envies the dictators of the UAE. Jacob Sullum writes for Reason magazine. This is from Reason.com. In a recent New York Times op-ed piece, Richard Falkenrath, who served as Deputy Homeland Security Advisor in the Bush administration and now works for former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff's consulting firm, explains why the BlackBerry ban from the United Arab Emirates announced last week, quote, met with approval, admiration, and perhaps even a touch of envy from law enforcement investigators and intelligence officers. The ban, continues Sullum, is perfectly reasonable in light of the UAE's legitimate security concerns, Falkenrath says, quote, because Research in Motion, the Canadian company that provides BlackBerry services, refused to modify its information architecture in a way that would enable authorities to intercept the communications of select subscribers. In other words, summarizes Sullum, the company declined to facilitate the authoritarian regime's snooping on BlackBerry users, a position that strikes Falkenrath as plainly unacceptable. This is a quote now from the op-ed by Falkenrath. Monitoring electronic communications in real time and retrieving stored electronic data are the most important counterterrorism techniques available to governments today. Electronic surveillance is particularly vital in combating global terrorism where the stakes are highest, but it is a part of virtually all investigations of serious transnational threats. The United Arab Emirates is in no way unique in wanting a backdoor into the telecommunications services used inside its borders to allow officials to eavesdrop on users. In the United States, telecommunications providers are generally required to provide a mechanism for such access by the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act of 1994 and related regulations issued by the Federal Communications Commission. Think about that for just a second. Way back in 1994, that's pre-Oklahoma City, that's pre-9/11 by 7 years. The Clinton administration was pushing, with the help of such dubious notables as then-Congressman Schumer, pushing for measures that would require telecommunications providers to hand over a key to unlock communications so as to facilitate real-time surveillance by the government. This wasn't a result of 9/11. It wasn't a result of Oklahoma City. That's just simply something that they required. Their default option is to keep us under perpetual surveillance, while, of course, punishing us as criminals if we dare to videotape or otherwise record our interactions with law enforcement. Falkenrath continues, as a general principle, information service providers here must provide a means for federal agencies, usually the FBI, to view the ostensibly private data, think about that, ostensibly private data, of their subscribers when lawfully ordered to do so. You can't lawfully order somebody to do something that is facially unconstitutional, but I continue. The FCC is not, however, a national security agency. It is an independent bipartisan commission whose members serve fixed terms. The commission interprets a variety of statutes and balances many different interests, including the business success of telecommunications providers and the convenience of consumers, and its rulings are subject to legal challenge in the courts. As a result, there remain a number of telecommunication methods the federal agencies cannot readily penetrate. Given the way FCC operates, the prospect of it taking a swift, decisive action to make these services accessible to the government is almost inconceivable. Hence the envy some American intelligence officials felt about the Emirates' decision, that is to say, to ban the use of BlackBerries because the Canadian company, Canada is a freer country than we are in many respects, the Canadian company refused to comply. Sullum comments, yes, dictators sure are good at avoiding legal barriers to surveillance. They are also never stymied because governmental intrusion into ostensibly private communications offends liberal sensibilities, as Falkenrath dismissively describes civil libertarian concerns about snooping in the name of national security. Let me read that again. governmental intrusion into ostensibly private communications offends liberal sensitivities. Yeah. Squishy proto-communist liberals like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison would have found this unacceptable. You know, James Madison wrote a document you may or may not have heard of, Mr. Falkenrath. It's called the United States Constitution. He was one of the chief authors of an amendment to that document called the First Amendment. Thomas Jefferson was likewise involved in this process, albeit in a somewhat distant way. Yes, we're talking about disreputable, radical, bomb-throwing, unsavory sorts like Jefferson and Madison. Their sensibilities are among the liberal sensibilities offended by open-ended government surveillance. Here are some other obstacles the UAE avoids, continues Solem, according to the State Department's most recent report on the country's human rights record: elections, representative government, an independent judiciary, governmental transparency, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, and freedom of religion. The State Department adds that, quote, there were unverified reports of torture during the year. There are verified reports of torture by the government ruling us, by the way. That security forces sometimes employed flogging as judicially sanctioned punishment. That arbitrary and incommunicado detention remained a problem, and that legal and societal discrimination against women and non-citizens, who represent 80% of the population, was pervasive. Nevertheless, says Falkenrath, the Emirates acted understandably and appropriately in banning Blackberries. The lesson of this episode, according to Falkenrath, quote, governments should not be timid about using their full powers to ensure that their law enforcement and intelligence agencies are able to keep their citizens safe. Some governments, of course, concludes Solem, have fuller powers than others, which makes their citizens and non-citizen residents extra safe. Oh, if only this were an Arab dictatorship, laments Richard Falkenrath, the former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to George W. Bush. Not to Barack Obama, to George W. Bush. You know, that ostensible born-again evangelical Christian president, that supposed conservative. This is a guy who was advising him, and he's thinking, we really would be better off if we were ruled in the same way that the subjects of the United Arab Emirates are ruled, by unaccountable Muslim dictators acting through unaccountable secret police agencies with infinite power. What a wonderful world it would be if only that were the case here, according to Falkenrath. So ends hour two of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I hope you'll be with us. Talk to you soon.